I want to welcome everyone back to the Pete Quiñones Show. It's about time I get back to reading this book, Race War in High School by Saltzman. My guest this evening is Tim Kelly. How are you doing, Tim?
Good evening. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Doing well. Need to finish this book up because it's been so eye-opening. But we're starting to get into the postmortems and see where how this all ends up.
It ends up in Welcome Back, Cotter, right?
Yeah, that's exactly. What's really funny, though, is there was a time where it basically the violence went away, the mass violence went away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was, you know, I mean, I was in public school at this time, and, you know, not at this time, but, you know, years at, you know, a good 15 years after this. And you had your typical fights, got, you know, people getting in, throwing punches and stuff like that. But it wasn't this mass, like, organized effort.
It wasn't political for the most part.
Right? Yeah. It was mostly, you know, give me your bus pass, that kind of crap.
Yeah.
But then, you know, they couldn't let it go. And then I think really the thing that kicked it off again was the Tawana Brawley thing up in upstate New York. You remember that?
Yeah, she claimed she had been kidnapped and sexually assaulted and raped and written like with markers and left in a dumpster, if I recall. And that was, of course, that's when Reverend Al Sharpton came on the national scene.
Oh yeah, that wonderful human being. Yeah, that's
FBI informant number 1574, something like that.
And just a very stupid human being.
Yes,
just a moron, and that's really being mean to morons.
I don't think he was he had been awarded the merit scholarship at any time in his academic career.
He was. I don't think he was a Regents graduate like myself in high school in New York.
But he knew he knew how to get publicity for himself. Yeah. And avoid paying off lawsuit settlements that he'd lost. You know?
There were times when he would have people go down into the train stations and stand in front of the trains. And stand in front of traffic on the bridges and train traffic on the bridges. I mean, the guy, he was the fact that people followed him probably says more about those people than it does about Al Sharpton. But
yeah, he was, I think, the inspiration for the character Reverend Bacon in Tom Wolfe's book, Bonfire of the Vanities.
Yeah. All right. So let me get this, let me share this so people can see it. All right, here we go. And Tim, you know you have permission to stop me at any time to comment. This, okay. Yep. Chapter 6, Union Politics and Postmortems. If John Lindsay's future was to be found at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., Albert Schenker's was at 815 16th Street Northwest, the headquarters of the AFL-CIO in the nation's capital. In 1969, the UFT president, head of the largest local union in America, narrowly missed election to George Meany's AFL-CIO executive council. He wouldn't miss the next time around. At the age of 41, his future seemed boundless. Like everything else in America, the nation's labor movement was undergoing rapid change. Its white face and blue-collar configuration was being modified as increasing numbers of black laborers, white-collar employees, and government workers were being unionized. So basically, he just described the three groups that make up progressivism.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny you had this growth of public employee unions at this time, which was an interesting development.
As the 1960s brought an influx of office workers and municipal employees into the ranks of organized labor, Albert Schenker was viewed by many as the one leader most capable of speaking for and to this newly emerging constituency within the labor movement, the blacks, the professionals, the white-collar workers, and the employees in the public sector. He was president of a local which by 1970 had a membership in excess of 56,000, the largest in the nation, and was about to add another 10,000 Black and Puerto Rican employees who had been recruited into the New York City school system as paraprofessionals, community people hired to assist teachers in the classroom.
Now, what type of community or what caliber were these people that could come into schools and help the teachers, supposedly?
I think when I mentioned them before, someone in the comments said that they had a parent or a grandparent who was working in the schools at this time, and they had to hide everything from the paraprofessionals because purses and anything of value would walk off when they were around.
Okay. So they didn't add to the academic or environment of...
Well, basically, they were supposed to be there to... if the students got rowdy, instead of the white face telling them to sit down, or what it should have been was sit down or I'm going to shoot you, they had someone in the community to tell them that, and they were getting paid, and now they're about to be unionized. Just as organized labor has seen its own future tied up in an alliance with the National Civil Rights Movement, the New York Teachers Union had ordered as its first priority a rebuilding of the coalition it had formed with the city's minority groups, a coalition that had been all but permanently destroyed by the Great School Strike of 1968.
And this was the Oceanfront Brownsville strike?
That was 1967, right? Yeah, I can't remember what this one was termed. I'd have to go back in the book, but
because I know that was one of the events that signaled the breakup of the Black Jewish Alliance that had been forged, you know, since 1909 with the opening of NAACP.
Yeah, this one, I think that one was localized, and this one was citywide.
Citywide, actually. Okay. I see.
Yeah. So, all right. That number one UFT priority was to operate in 1969 to the detriment of high school teachers in general and of those of Franklin K. Lane in particular. The 1968 school strike had elevated Shenker to a position of national prominence. Labor unions all over the country recognized the implications of the Ocean Hill style of community control, and realizing that the UFT was fighting only the first phase of a battle that might ultimately come to them, they were quite willing to contribute the $220,000 George Meany had called for to pay the fine that would certainly be imposed against the teachers' union for its illegal strike. The New York State Taylor Law specifically prohibited strikes by public employees. I mean, doesn't that... I mean, first of all...
Then why was there a strike?
Well, why are there public unions?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, how do state employees get union? Well, Shankers, good.
They have these rare skills that can't be obtained anywhere else, so they're easy to unionize because they're high level of competency and skill.
Yeah.
Shankers, and also they donate a lot of money to politicians after they sign these huge, you know, compensation agreements, and then they kick back to the politicians. And right, 30 years later, the city goes bankrupt.
And I think in the last chapter, it said that that Shenker had set it up so that the union donated equally to the three mayoral candidates in the previous election. So they didn't seem to be choosing sides. So whoever won, they were golden.
So they buy the support with the taxpayer money, and then you kick it back to the politician, but then returns the favor with, you know, salary increases and, you know, I guess compensation packages and, you know, with retirement packages.
It's just all money laundering, it really
is. In the meantime, they're supposed to be educating somebody, right?
Is that what they do? Is that what they're supposed to be doing?
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Shanker's stock rose even higher a year later when he made a gigantic $60,000 contribution to the International Brotherhood of Electric Workers during the extended General Electric strike. And he won unprecedented prestige among old line labor men with the UFT's nationally distributed pro-IBEW lesson plans designed for use in classrooms and teaching about the General Electric strike.
I think it's funny, these donations, whenever I read these things back in like pre-1970s, it's always in thousands and tens of thousands of dollars. Because it's pre-inflationary 70s, but I guess back then $60,000 was a large contribution, political contribution.
Oh, very much so. I mean, what was the average house at that time? $15,000-$20,000.
Yeah, I always get a kick out of the salaries that people get. Like, I'm making $5,400 a year. What?
I remember my mother telling me what she was making in the late 60s, and I was like, you just shake your head because we grew up in inflation times. Albert Shanker was slowly bringing his union out of the snobbish provincialism that had traditionally kept it aloof from the working class and was steering it into the mainstream of the American labor movement. This virtually guaranteed his election to the AFL-CIO Executive Council the next time around. David Selden, president of the 109,000-member parent body, the American Federation of Teachers, would normally have been the choice for the AFL-CIO slot, but he was in no position to stand in Shanker's way. The New York local, with its 60,000 members, misrepresented almost a third of the... The New York local, with its 60,000 members, represented almost a third of the AFT's total membership. I don't know why that was such a difficult sentence for me.
There's a Freudian slip, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, but also, as we mentioned in previous episode, of those 60,000 members, two-thirds belong to, I think they're Amish.
So there are 60,000 teachers. Have that right? Yes. In New York?
Yes, and 40,000 of them are Amish.
I guess just because they work hard?
I don't know. Yeah, and then you have Shanker and Selden.
And people wonder why there are problems in public education.
While Selden was one of Shanker's closest friends, he knew where the national's base of power was located. New York Giant Local was the heart of the national body, and Albert Shanker was the power behind the throne. It was something Dave Selden could never forget, not for a moment, even as he rubbed shoulders with the highest officialdom of government in Washington, D.C. Selden and Shanker had been joined by George Altomare in the 1950s to form the triumvirate that gave the American Federation of Teachers its very first local union with collective bargaining rights. In the late 50s and early 60s, the Selden-Shanker-Altomare combination made the teachers' union in New York City. George Altomare began his teaching career as a social studies instructor in a Queens County junior high school after his graduation from the City College of New York in 1953. I'm just remembering something that Murray Rothbard once said. He said that he said the CCNY stood for Circumcised Citizens of New York because that was one of the only schools that would take Jews in the early 1900s.
That's before circumcision was normalized.
Oh, man. The degradation to which teachers were subjected by an educational system based on caste pushed Altomare into the union movement. It had been the traditional policy of the city school boards to keep teachers divided by cultivating differences among them and by playing off the many different teacher organizations against one another.
So Machiavelli now. I admire that.
Yeah, I mean, hey. By pitting group against group, division against division, the school board had been successful in preventing the formation of any one single professional organization that could speak for all the system's employees. The net result was that teachers were among the poorest paid employees in New York. In 1958, the starting salary was $4,000 a year. In 1953, Altomare found himself on the same faculty with Albert Shanker, Sol Levine, future UFT vice president, and Dan Sanders, eventual UFT public relations director, at Junior High School 126 in Queens. There,
Shanker, Levine, Sanders.
Yep. there's patterns. There, in opposition to what they viewed as a tyrannical administration, they formed a militant chapter of the New York City Teachers Guild, the forerunner of the UFT. Shanker and Altomare, both in their mid-20s, made it to the executive board of the 3,000-member guild and injected new life into the organization. By 1956, Shanker was organizing full-time for the guild as a special representative employed by the National AFT, while Selden working for the guild as its full-time director of organization. But it was Altomare, who had moved on to a teaching post at Franklin K. Lane High School, who made the most outstanding contribution toward the achievement of a single unified teacher union in New York. The greatest obstacle to unity was the powerful High School Teachers Association, which had consistently refused to merge with a guild. It was Altomare who ingeniously laid the foundation for a merger with a dissident group within the HSTA.
Now, this is all being done to improve education, right?
Yes. Yeah. Isn't that, that's the point, right? Isn't that why people become teachers? Mm-hmm. Isn't that why people become police? Because they want to protect and serve? Isn't that why people become politicians? Because they want to serve the people?
I've seen all the movies, like, I don't know, like Blackboard Jungle, To Sir with Love. What was the other one? Up the Down Staircase. Remember that one? The heroic teachers. And then the later ones, like Stand and Deliver. And what was the other one?
Those are so terrible.
Who's the one with the lady?
It was Michelle Pfeiffer, wasn't it?
Michelle Pfeiffer, and she... She learns more than the kids, by the way, at the end of the movie,
of course. Yeah, it's like the end of every South Park episode. I learned something today. Disagreements had been the normal order of things among elementary, junior high school, and senior high school teachers. The latter group earned a higher salary because they were required to show more college credits than teachers in the other divisions. The guild, whose limited strength was outside the high schools, had as one of its major policy positions a single salary schedule for all teachers. So it doesn't matter who, how well you're educated. It doesn't matter how well your students score on, you know, testing, however you feel about.
Or what you're teaching, like testing. Chemistry versus, you know, history or something.
Yeah, or a gym teacher.
Yeah, this is the word that, you know, remember the issue of merit pay and all that?
Yeah.
That was in the 80s, and education with all that. So basically everyone just, it's all the same no matter what. So you don't, how you perform doesn't, it's basically just tenure, how long you stay there. Mm-hmm. You know, if no one sets you on fire.
Yeah. Well, this looks promising. This was to be achieved by giving the lower grade teachers the opportunity to earn as much money as high school teachers if they produced the same number of college credits. The HST, on the other hand, demanded the maintenance of the salary and status differential based on the notion that high school teachers were a cut above their counterparts in the lower grades. So we got class war going on.
Mm-hmm.
There had been numerous meetings between Guild and HSTA officials between 1956 and 1959 aimed at merger, but high school teachers rebuffed their own leadership each time HSTA officials broached the subject of merger and parity. The first opportunity for a breakthrough came in 1959. A group of high school teachers who worked in the city's 16 evening high schools to supplement their day school income voted to strike the evening schools. It was the first time any group of New York City school employees dared challenge the state's Condon-Wadlin law, which called for the dismissal of striking teachers. The strike, and can we talk about the fact that who are these evening school teachers teaching exactly?
I'm trying to figure that out. Are there kids going to school in the evening?
Are these the ones that are hooked on? I mean, you read the first couple chapters, and it's like, oh, there's kids, there's high school kids shooting heroin in school.
Yeah, and the grievance is it pay or is it the fact that they're teaching in a war zone?
I mean, hazard pay would definitely be.
Yeah,
something that I mean, I would just walk out. There's no way. I've said it numerous times reading this. There's no way. I mean, there's if I was a white student, I wouldn't be going back. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Well, that's another thing when you talk about the racial problems. The racial problems are always black kids beating up white kids. Like, I guess you could say it's racial, but you're really not describing the situation or the circumstances or the nature of the conflict.
By the way, Tim, happy Martin Luther King Day.
Right. Stanley Levinson Day. I mean, Martin Luther King Day.
Oh, that's awesome.
This old joke was that, you know, if Stanley Levinson were alive today, he'd be a conservative. So.
Oh. The strike of the evening school teachers was a landmark, a huge success resulting in salary gains approaching 100%. Again, what are the students getting out of this?
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, it brought together Guild and HSTA activists on the picket lines for the first time, both ardently supporting the strike of the independent evening school teachers. That 1959 strike was a watershed, proving first that people from the rival organizations could work together, and second, that in unity, New York school teachers could make great strides forward.
The evening classes, was that a function of overcrowding, perhaps?
I don't remember that. This is, I don't remember them mentioning evening teachers, evening classes before in the book.
I thought maybe they'd have like a schedule. They'd stagger the classes like a one full day, and they because of the overcrowding issue, they'd shift to the evening or something. I don't know.
Well, they definitely had the they had overlapping. So there would be like 10 period days, and like students would come in for 7 of those periods, and then another set of students would come in the third period and stay through to the end. But mm-hmm. I don't know about these evening classes. I'm assuming when it comes to these evening classes and the students, I'm just basically assuming the worst.
Well, maybe like a workable solution would have been like day classes for the white kids and evening classes for black kids.
But they're just getting, I mean, they just had the Great Society is what, 3 years old, four yes. years old. This is great.
Well, I figure, you know, classes end and they can go play midnight basketball.
Oh, yeah.
See?
Just thinking of a joke. A friend of mine made an evening basketball reference the other day and a couple months ago. And my response probably got us taken down from YouTube. So. All right, going on. The evening teacher strike set the stage for new secret merger talks between Altomare and the HSTA dissidents with whom he had worked and who also wanted a single united organization. It was Altomare's great triumph, and both Selden and Shanker took a back seat to the young high school teacher. Endowed with great talents of diplomacy and personal persuasion, he manipulated the older and more experienced HSTA leaders. Even the guild president, Charles Cogan, watched in amazement as Altomare wheeled and dealed, breaking the HSTA leadership apart. By fomenting dissension from within their ranks, he brought enough HSTA dissidents into secondary positions of leadership within the guild to give the impression that a bona fide merger had been accomplished. It had a snowball effect as more high school teachers came over until the legitimate HSTA officials had no choice but to go along. George Altomare, almost single-handedly, achieved a minor miracle. By 1960, the newly created United Federation of Teachers was petitioning the school board for a collective bargaining election to determine which organization would have exclusive rights to bargain for and represent all the city's teachers. Now, I'm not saying that I mean, obviously, teachers are getting paid and they want to get paid. I'm just saying that what we see as the fruits of all of this is race war and teacher getting set on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And then what, 5 years after this, 4 years after this, 5 years after this, Johnson basically destroys the United States for, and we've been suffering through what he did ever since.
Mm-hmm. So, $1 trillion later?
Yep. Altamare's star was about to reach its zenith. He had been strike chairman for the Guild in addition to being a member of its executive board. In the 1960 post-merger election, he won the position of assistant treasurer, and in 1961, he was elected vice president for the academic high schools, a post he retained for the entire decade of the 60s, except for a 2.5-year stint as a full-time UFT organizer. In the meantime, Albert Schenker had continued to work for and advise the newly created union as a full-time AFT staffer. But in 1962, he plunged into the organization's political maze, running for and winning the post of secretary on the ticket headed by Union President Charles Cogan. Slates headed by Cogan, Schenker, and Altamare went on to outpoll opposition tickets for practically all officer and executive board positions, and the Unity Caucus soon emerged as the most powerful and broadly based party in the union. In 1962, the UFT leadership negotiated its first contract, the first ever for a teacher organization anywhere in the nation, and they were on their way. They had called two strikes, each for a one-day duration. The first one took place in 1960 to force a collective bargaining election that the board was trying to put off, and another one-day stoppage in 1962 pressed home the union's negotiating demands. By 1963, it was a well-established organization with the fastest-growing membership in the labor movement.
And this is despite the fact that the law prohibiting such a union had not been repealed.
Yes. Yes. I wonder if they're going to go into that when it does get repealed, or if it does, or if it's one of those laws that they just, it gets overlooked to the point, like pretty much all the laws when it comes to public sector workers when in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. The UFT successfully negotiated its first contract in 1962, and a new two-year agreement was ratified in 1963. Charles Cogan, president of the Guild since 1952, had the grandfather image necessary to win teacher confidence and public support for the struggling new union in the early 60s. But Cogan, an eminently decent person, never had the ruthless ambition or political savvy to consolidate his hold at the on the top spot, and by 1964, his ability to control and direct the leadership of the rapidly growing local was questionable. And after having been the brains behind the power for 8 years, Albert Schenker was getting impatient. In 1964, the Selden, Schenker, Altamare triumvirate mapped out the future of the New York local as well as that of the parent national body. Cogan would be eased out and replaced by Schenker as the unity candidate in the 1964 union general election. That summer, they would put Cogan forth as the progressive candidate for the AFT presidency, which until then had been controlled by Charles Meggle of the more conservative Chicago local. If Cogan won, Selden would go with him as number two man in the national organization and his likely successor. And let's just keep coming back to the question of how this has helped to improve education.
Yeah. People, yeah, I guess they're building their own little political empires. And
yeah. It worked out precisely the way they planned it for everyone except George Altamare. Most people thought in terms of a Schenker-Altamare ticket in 1964 with the high school vice president running for secretary, the number two spot on the slate. It was a natural. Schenker and Altamare were contemporaries. They had begun their teaching careers together at the same junior high school in Queens. holding similar socio-political views. I can just imagine what those are. holding similar socio-political views, they were a highly compatible team. And in those early years of union activism, they developed a close friendship. Altomare recognized and respected Shanker's gifted intellect, and Shanker acknowledged the organizing prowess and charismatic personality that enabled Altomare to draw hundreds of teachers to do volunteer work for the fledgling union. Never could Shanker, having yet to develop the necessary social maturity, hope to hold the personal loyalties that the more gregarious Altomare commanded as a UFT network chairman, a post which kept him in constant contact with the union's school-based grassroots leadership. I mean, can you even consider yourself to be grassroots at this point when you've just basically turned yourself into a political machine?
Who's your constituency?
Well, yeah. That's a really good question, because it's obviously not the kids.
This emphasis on organization, and they're like Bolsheviks. It's like these acronyms and everything.
Comparing them to Bolsheviks, that's the most racist thing I've heard you say.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry. Mensheviks, sorry.
Probably a little bit closer. Yeah. Altomare was bitterly disappointed in 1964 when Shanker chose an old-timer, Jules Kolodny, over him for the second spot on the ticket.
Kolodny.
Mm-hmm. But he consoled himself with a reasonably certain feeling that after the AFT election, Shanker would tab him for the post of director of organization, which Dave Selden would vacate in moving up to the AFT leadership with Kogan. There were many who thought in 1964 that George Altomare should have been the unity candidate for president ahead of Shanker. After all, it was Altomare who had engineered the great merger, Altomare whose organizing skills had put together a successful network, and Altomare as the chief architect of two highly successful and painless strikes who held the loyalties that could put him over. But the high school vice president never thought of challenging Shanker for the top job, and at Shanker's request, he even stepped aside for Kolodny. For George Altomare, it was the beginning of a long downward slide. The Shanker-Kolodny ticket was victorious in 1964, as it was in 1966, 1968, and 1970, and that summer it was Altomare and Selden who personally engineered the Kogan insurgency at the AFT convention in Chicago. Now George Altomare waited for his promotion to that prize spot.
These conventions, AFT conventions, are they like discussing pedagogical methods and what's the best for students?
I mean, I'm basically assuming it is any kind of union meeting. It's just typical of what a union meeting would be since, the early 1900s, late 1800s. Just has to be. Yeah, I mean, you want to be a fly on the wall just to see how many times students are mentioned,
mm-hmm,
or education is mentioned.
Well, it's a little different, like with a trade union, because they're negotiating with management to get a bigger cut of the pie, so to speak. And, they're producing a product, which they ultimately have to sell. Whereas you have a public school system that's supposedly created for the benefit of the public, and of course the public pays for it. But you have this, cabal, if you will, organizing and sort of getting a hold of the public school system, at least a big chunk of it, part of it, and just conspiring and, to get theirs and organize it. And then who knows, all the trouble that you read about in this book is largely their doing because of the policies they've either implemented or promoted, their social values or their outlook. One of which was, of course, the holy objective of integration, and never questioning that, of course, despite it was a obviously a manifest disaster from an educational and social standpoint.
Right. Yeah. And
and they never say, I'm sorry. They say, you're welcome.
Right. And
move on.
And basically when the strife starts happening, when the violence starts happening, they're so on autopilot that they don't want to interrupt that. You see it in the decisions when they get together and they want to make demands. They're like, these are the demands we want. And the demands are not that this element that is causing the problems needs to be exercised and removed. It's okay. We need to get, we were on autopilot. We're hitting some bumps. And what do we do to make it smooth again? But we can't address what the real problem is. And I mean, that's what progressivism is it's this seemingly everything's getting better. Everything's getting better. So when a problem presents itself, it's somebody else's fault. It can't be their organization. It has to be, it can't be somebody's nature that isn't mixing in and working well in an integrated situation. It's just something, a problem that they've created that they have to have the solution for. That's what I meant to say. And that's basically that's what progressivism, that's what basically government has become, what oligarchical, democratic, whatever you want to call this government.
This the presumption that what they call it, a racial balance, as if what's the proper balance, and the presumption that is a desirable goal, and it's achievable goal and a practical goal, and they never question that. It's part of the civil rights ideology, and so when it predictably creates a disaster and violence and these things, and usually it is one side committing most of the violence. Their response is, well, we need instead of reversing that policy, they'll say, well, we need more security in the schools. When no one bothers thinking, how come 30 years ago no one needed a cop in a school?
Yeah.
You know, what happened? And then they talk about the changing society. Well, who's changing the society? Happening.
Yeah. What kind of violence and what kind of problems were there in schools before 1954?
Yes.
That's the question.
Yeah. We see this recently in Virginia, and this is the governor, Glenn Youngkin, is criticizing the decision. There were 7 schools in the Fairfax County who decided to hide the merit awards from the top students to promote equity, because it made those who didn't get it feel like they're second class or I guess deficient one way or another academically. Well, they are, relative to the people who won the merit scholarship award. 7 schools in Virginia admitted to not informing the students of their prestigious national merit recognition. Involved in this, a lot of it's money, because it's also scholarship. You're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars of value here. And the kids aren't being told that they won these things, so they can put it on their applications, their records. It's all because too many the people getting it tend to be ethnic Asians or ethnic whites, not too few Blacks or Hispanics. Surprise, surprise. So what they're doing is, because the achievement gap stubbornly stays, they can't close this achievement gap. They just decide to ignore reality and just stop, no longer acknowledge achievement, or merit, because these are the top 3 in the country, are thinking, 55,000 students out of millions of students or something. So they decided just to not to talk about it because out of it, and the county hired like a what they called a equity diversity consultant, paid him close to $500,000. Her, I don't know who it was, to come up with this plan. So reading, this is 1970, you know, 60s and early 70s. It just doesn't change.
No. They're going to keep this going. I mean, they created a great grift, and they're not going to let that let that go. All right, what happened to poor George Altamare here? Now, George Altamare waited for his promotion to that prize spot, organization director, but that reward never came. For Shanker, in a shrewd and calculated political maneuver, swung his support in the administrative committee to John O'Neill, a former guild organizer and junior high school vice president. For Altamare, this was a stunning setback. As a ranking officer, chairman of the strike network, a loyal supporter and personal friend of the new president, he had expected Shanker's endorsement for the director job. All the years of complete devotion and self-sacrifice for the movement seemed wasted. He was shunned in favor of a man whose credentials were not nearly as imposing as his own. For almost 11 years, he had toiled teaching school until 3 p.m. and then rushing over to Guild, later UFT headquarters in Manhattan, to work out the details of an organizational campaign, merger talks, and strike strategy. If in those formative years there was a single man in the movement who could be called indispensable, it surely would have to be George Altamare. But 11 years of laboring around the clock had taken its toll. A hardened union veteran at age 33, he made the fateful decision to give up his vice presidency to take a lesser job as a full-time UFT organizer. It was a post well beneath his enormous structure, but he could no longer face the prospect of yet another year of coming to Lane early every morning to face students whom he no longer had the desire to teach.
So you wonder why.
And then beginning his real work day at 4 p.m. at the union office, a day that rarely ended before the wee hours in the morning. By 1964, he was tired physically and emotionally spent, and the full-time organizing job was a straw. He grabbed it. Altamare became a member of the full-time UFT staff in 1964, and although Shanker let him retain the network chairmanship, he could never quite accept the automatic relegation to a non-policy-making role. For Shanker, Altamare represented an internal threat, the man who was in constant communication with the union's grassroots leaders.
This is like reading the early accounts of the Russian Revolution and the early days of the Bolshevik regime, and the maneuvering of Trotsky and Stalin and Kamenev and Radek, all these guys.
Well, the only difference is the peasants were the one who were violent in this one.
Yes.
And every classroom teacher remembered Altamare as the man who was always in the forefront of their proudest victories. Conscious of having dropped Altamare in favor of Kolodny and then O'Neill, and of having cleverly manipulated him out of the political leadership, Shanker continued to whittle away at the former vice president's power and prestige. And Altamare, psychologically unable to accept his new non-political role in the union he had helped found, often clashed with the new president who was anxious to establish his power and image.
When you have institutions like this, bureaucracies that are, largely out of the public exposure or oversight, no one's covering these details. That's been written up in an obscure book, and they're all pretty much conspiring against the public, right? Just what this is, and no one's looking out for the taxpayer in this. And how do, like, I'm figuring people who go to work every day and have to come back, deal with their family. This is the internal political problem. This is why everything's like an oligarchy.
Yeah, this is exactly what is it? Parnell's law, all those laws about how when you put together a union or something like that, even if it's the plans in the beginning are ideological, eventually the bureaucrats are going to take over. Mm-hmm. It always happens, no matter what. So
every cause becomes a racket, then turns into a business or corporation or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and Altomare is psychologically unable to accept his new non-political role in the union he had helped found, often clashed with the new president, who was anxious to establish his own power and image. The relationship between the two men became strained. Neither was able or willing to respect the other's needs.
Did the Catholic school in New York have these same political problems?
The Catholic schools, as far they're not unionized.
How do they educate?
Well, I mean, a couple ones I went to, I mean, a couple of them weren't great at it. The schools I went to were fine. I mean, I went to a Jesuit school, and of course that was, you know, classical education. Mm-hmm. But then I ended up going to a couple regular kind of Catholic schools, and I mean, the education was fine. It was just a matter of, do you want the education?
I mean, but they don't have this mid-level intrigue and maneuvering and political battling. I mean, every school has its own politics, don't get me wrong. I understand that, 'cause that's just human nature, but it's much leaner, and it's more, I guess, mission focused, because of the economics of it all, I guess you could say. Whereas just as,
Well, I mean, you know that within any diocese, there's going to be its own politics.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely church politics, of course. Yes, you go to any school board meeting and all that, even in privately owned school, you're going to get that. But I guess that's just nature of bureaucracy, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. This it's so big and so unwieldy and huge, and then becomes a huge political, a political football or issue that factors into mayoral elections and who have presidential ambitions. Think about that. Of course, it's also New York City. So,
I mean, the Catholic high school diocese was nowhere near as big as this. I mean, I went to school on 44th Street in Manhattan, and my graduating class was 97 people.
Mm-hmm.
Where this school right here we're talking about at one point had 5,400. 100 in the whole school. I mean, we had like 400. Our school was like 400. This school was 5,400.
Isn't that sort of dystopic in its own way?
Yeah.
Just the size of it. So,
yeah.
For the students, I'm saying it's intimidating. Think about it. I mean, then you inject racial integration or racial balance into the mix. And so you inject all of society's problems, which really aren't the fault of these students, who are forced to be the guinea pigs in this experiment. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. They're I'll keep that to myself. All right. By 1967, Altomare decided to get back into politics and run for his old vice presidency. Shanker, realizing that he couldn't keep him out without splitting the caucus and paying too expensive a price, decided to support his comeback. Confident of Shanker's backing in the Unity primary, Altomare returned to Lane in February 1967 to establish his credentials as a candidate in that spring's union election. So am I hearing this properly? He's basically going back to teaching just so he can establish cred?
For the kids.
The disruptive child issue, which came to the fore in 1967. we both like that year a lot, don't we?
1967, yes, it was a very important year for me.
Me too.
It's Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band came out, right?
That is, you are correct.
It was also the year of The Graduate, so the movie. But
Yes. So really the year that... you really started to see a turn in public sentiment for the Vietnam War as well.
Yeah, that was the yeah.
Yeah. The disruptive child issue, which came to the fore in 1967, must be understood in the light of the union's internal politics generally, and more specifically in view of the Altomare resurgence. Okay, let's get to this. He had returned to Lane to find his old school in the grips of student disruption. Mm-hmm. That's a great way of putting students ODing in the high school, teachers being raped and students being beaten and, you know, basically brutalized. Yeah, that's good.
Now, who's doing this? Who are these disruptive students?
Oh, I mean, the Irish.
Well, you know, the Irish, you can't, you know.
Yeah. He had returned to Lane to find his old school in the grips of student disruption, unlike anything he had known prior to his leaving in 1964. He came back to Lane, his political future on the line, anxious for an issue that would propel him back into the limelight. Between 1959 and 1964, he had been Mr. Union, his name a household word among city teachers. But 2.5 years of being buried in the glamorous paperwork of the central office saw his prominence diminish. Now he faced a hard uphill battle in the unity primary against the incumbent, Martin Lobenthal.
Mm-hmm.
And if successful, an even tougher fight in the general election against the strong opposition candidate, popular old-time Bronx militant Ben Kaplan.
Wasn't Leon Trotsky one time a Bronx militant? Did he live there for a while?
He did. He actually did live in the Bronx.
Yes. Yeah. Had a refrigerator.
Yes, he did. And indoor plumbing. Said yeah. He mentioned that clearly, actually. He stressed that. But the disruption at Lane gave Altomare an issue, and using the Lane chapter to spearhead a confrontation with District 19 Superintendent Margaret Douglas, he claimed public credit for a nebulous victory that Douglas never acknowledged and later refuted. The disruptive child issue would become a key in demand in the coming round of negotiations.
Disruptive child, is that just like just a consequence of integration?
I think this book clearly proves that. And I think that is why this book had to be demonized and basically disappeared for so long.
So all the problems that came from that and all the people that opposed integration, which led to busing, who in the history textbooks are, you know, are treated as racist, you know, reprobates, retrograde rather. But everything they warned about happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. And, But
they were on the wrong side of history, so that's okay.
And they were all racist. So
they're all racist, yeah, yes.
Of course, yeah. Had the incumbent vice president stayed in the race, Kaplan may have emerged the winner. But in a two-man contest, Altomare managed to eke out the narrowest of victories, a 180-vote margin, representing a difference of only 3 votes in each of the 60 academic high schools. He returned to the union in the fall of 1967 as a full-time vice president while the Lane chapter continued to struggle with the problem of student disruption. He had used his school to get elected, but now Lane was no longer among his major concerns. He had always been extremely sensitive about paying too much attention to the problems of his home school. A politician of the first order, he was ever fearful of the prospect of being criticized for doing too much for his own Franklin Lane. Contributing to the neglect of Lane's problems was the fact that during the 1967 to 70 period, the UFT had relegated the high schools to the lowest priority among the union's needs. So while all of this is going on, it's just but low priority.
Well, it's, I would say with when it comes to something like integration or racial balancing, the high schools would have most of the problems just because the age of the students. You have less problems in elementary school.
Well, yeah, they're going physically they're going to be closer to adults.
Yeah, So yeah. They'll be beating up teachers, where you won't get that in second grade. Although now I hear six year olds are now shooting teachers. So
yeah, well, I mean, if you know, the teachers were doing their job right, they wouldn't have to be. Never mind. When I heard that, I heard somebody on Twitter was like, what is this 7-year-old? Why does a 7-year-old need to have a gun? Why does a 7-year-old have a gun? I'm like, well, because, I mean, if your people stopped committing all the crime, it wouldn't have to, 7-year-olds wouldn't have to carry guns.
Yeah.
I was being facetious, but
it yes.
Was. All right.
That's the gun rights advocate's solution for gun violence in school. Everyone be armed, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The organization had committed itself to such programs as the More Effective Schools Plan, which became a national program sponsored by the AFT to saturate ghetto schools with additional teaching services and personnel.
Oh, you know, that worked well.
Yeah. sure. I mean, I basically went to first or eighth grade, I went to ghetto schools. It was great. It was wonderful. It's fantastic. Altomare, in a political box, sidestepped the major high school problems and, in accordance with his philosophy of avoiding controversy, allowed the high school problems to fester rather than fight to make the divisional difficulties an object of the union's action. It is paradoxical that what he had always sought to avoid, controversy, came upon him by his own doing just 3 months after he resumed his vice presidency. For Altomare, the 1967 school strike had been a humiliating experience. He had always been part of the frontline negotiating team. Even as a staff representative, he played a major role in the 1965 settlement. But 1967 was a different story. It was the first time New York teachers struck for more than one day. When the stoppage entered its third week, the scene moved to Gracie Mansion, where night after night, George Altomare found himself sleeping on an air mattress on the floor of a chilly waiting room, while inside, Shanker and Kolodny negotiated the terms of the settlement with board president Giardino, Donovan, and Lindsay. This was the first time Altomare had been cut out of top-level bargaining, and it was even more painful knowing that inside, his archenemy Kolodny was negotiating away key high school demands he was certain could have been won. And do you think that was like student focused or teacher focused?
Personal bodyguards for teachers. Yeah. I just love that they're just fighting when the society is just crumbling all around them. No one's addressing why all this is happening, but okay.
Well, you're not supposed to, you know, Tim, causation doesn't equal correlation.
That's right.
How does that phrase go? Yeah, is that
correlation and causation, whatever.
Yeah, causation, yeah. So it's come on.
Sometimes it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had somebody was talking about how the South, from like Mississippi up to like South Carolina, how bad the gun laws were, how lax the gun laws are, and how much murder happens. And so, you know, some of us just found a map of, you know, where a certain segment of the population mostly lives, mm-hmm. and overlaid it over the map. Do you want to guess what that person said? Correlation doesn't equal causation.
Okay, so yeah. So
yeah. Yeah. So all right. For the first time in 14 years of close personal and professional association, Altomare broke with Albert Shanker, using as his excuse the claim that class size for non-college bound black students in the academic high schools might actually increase under the formula arrived at with the board. Altomare voted against the settlement terms in the negotiating committee. So what do we have here? So he's saying that, using as his excuse the claim that class size for non-college bound black students in the academic high schools, why are non-college bound students in an academic high school?
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't they be in a trade school or something of the sort. So, yeah. Ugh. All right. Joined by John O'Neill, who had given up the staff director's job to resume his post as junior high school vice president, and by assistant treasurer Richard Parrish, he led the fight against ratification in the executive board. It was a tense session, but after much emotional debate, the body voted to sustain Shanker and approve the pact. George Altomare emerged from the executive session beaten, but not yet ready to give up his fight. Visibly shaken by the bloodletting inside the executive boardroom, he headed for the TV cameras that were set up outside the meeting room in the lobby of the union's Park Avenue South headquarters. The newsmen sensed a division in the union's leadership and were hot on the trail of a breaking story. Altomare didn't let them down. He wasn't ready to give up. There was still the delegate assembly that evening, the third part of a four-step ratification procedure. In front of the grinding cameras, he announced that the union's acceptance of the pact was a sellout of both teachers and the black community. So just appeal to emotionalism on both sides and just appeal to anger on both sides. Now it was no longer an internal UFT matter. Shanker followed him, accusing the vice president of raising a phony issue and hailing the agreement as the best ever won by teachers anywhere. It was the kind of episode neither man would ever forget, one from which Altomare would never recover, and one from which Shanker would never forgive him. It was all out in the open the night of September 28, 1967, at the Manhattan Center on West 34th Street as the union's 1,500 delegates gathered to see a live reenactment of the Shanker-Altomare feud they had seen on television earlier in the evening. They had come to choose their hero, and the mood of the delegates seemed clearly against the settlement terms. They cheered wildly as George Altomare made his way to the stage to deliver his minority report. But he was no match for Albert Shanker before a large body. The president described the contract as the best ever. He was magnificent, and the most anti-Shanker elements had to admit that here was a truly gifted person. He sold them on the settlement, a settlement that was substantially the same as the one he had implored them to reject before the 14-day strike.
Well, I guess he was just exploiting his high verbal IQ.
I think his is very high. By the time Altomare followed to present the minority report, most of the delegates had already been swung over by Shanker's methodological argumentation. And then there was the fact that over the years, Altomare's most glaring weakness had been his deficiency in public speaking. The high school vice president droned on for 30 minutes, going off on tangents, dealing in technicalities few of the delegates understood or cared about, and before he was halfway through, most of the assemblage had tuned out. In the end, the delegates voted overwhelmingly to accept the terms of the new agreement, and it was all over for George Altomare. He had gambled and lost, and he would now have to pay the heavy price for his opposition. The union president, angered at what he considered an inexcusable betrayal by the Altomare-led troika, began creating around himself a new top-level cabinet of trusted advisors outside the core of elected officers. See what he's doing? Mm-hmm. His newly assigned special assistant.
Yeah, all for the kids.
Yeah, 100%. This is going to make their lives so much better. His newly assigned special assistant, Sandra Feldman, staff director DeLeonardis, and Sanders, his public relations chief, now became his most intimate confidants, to whom he turned for guidance on major policy questions. Joining his kitchen cabinet was Bayard Rustin, the noted black civil rights leader and executive director of A. Philip Randolph Institute, Tom Kahn as the leader for industrial democracy, and the socialist author Michael Harrington.
Oh, yeah. The other America guy. Yeah. He's a socialist Catholic. Yeah.
What? Oh, was he?
He's the one that wrote The Other America. Sort of
Oh.
The would have been, it's kind of like, I would say, the what wealth and poverty was to like the 1980s supply side revolution. The other America was to the, like the Great Society, so you know,
oh,
poverty and all that. So
interesting.
But one thing that gets me is you negotiate an agreement and it's signed, sealed, and delivered. Just as a practical matter, how busy can a union organizer be after all that deal is made?
Yeah.
I mean, to see to me, it should be like a part-time job where you go off and go find some honest work in the meantime until you have another issue or something. And then you raise the issue, but you've made the agreement. So what's the union going to do other than maybe just make sure that the agreement terms are met? But that, again, I'm being facetious. Because, I mean, you're always out there causing trouble, scheming. But I'm thinking, okay, the agreement's made, so what's Al Shanker going to do? He's going to form a kitchen cabinet and form a cabal and strategize and think about what else, well, more trouble he can cause, I guess. I don't know. So,
and within the official official administrative committee of 11 UFT officers, Treasurer Witz, Secretary Kolodny, and elementary school's Vice President Abe Levine served as the hatchet men, ostracizing the high school official and making it all but impossible for him to function. The revolt over ratification was only the first of a series of Altomare-Shanker battles during the 1967.
Oh, sorry, what do they mean by him and impossible for him to function? In what capacity?
I mean, I would assume within the... Is he still in the union?
Within the union, because he's a high school official, right? So he served some capacity at a high school, right?
Right.
So when they say make it impossible for him to function, are they keeping him from doing his job at the high school and then hurting the education of the students? I'm just trying.
Yeah, they do. The inclusion of high school official in that sentence does seem to imply that. The revolt over ratification was only the first of a series of Altomare-Shanker battles during the 1967-68 school year. The most violent split came over the AFL-CIO endorsement of the Johnson administration's Vietnam policy. This was an issue of conscience to many of the 51-member UFT executive board, and the lines were drawn to get the local and the parent AFT to disassociate themselves from the AFL-CIO's support of the nation's Vietnam policy.
But what was their position on what was going on in Israel at the time? Palestine.
Sorry, about the 67 war?
But this is about that time.
Oh, I can guess.
I guess they haven't heard of the U.S. Liberty incident. We can excuse them on that. Most of America didn't hear about it 2 years later.
Really? But Albert Shanker, firmly aligned with the AFL-CIO hawks on the war issue, knew that to bolt meanie on Vietnam would be to throw himself into the renegade camp of United Auto Workers head Walter Reuther, and destroy his own hopes of climbing the ladder of the national labor movement. So he battled fiercely against the anti-war faction of his own executive board in New York, a faction that included in its leadership George Altomare and John O'Neill. The clash between the two giants continued well into the spring of 1968. Preoccupied with his own internal nightmare, Altomare had little time for the crisis that was brewing in Franklin K. Lane.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, his job, but, you know.
I love that. The thorny
right,
problem.
I'm sorry, he's an official at Franklin K. Lane school, right?
Yeah, he's what was the term we
high school official?
High school official, yes.
Okay, so
yeah, it seems like more than a teacher.
More than a teacher. So you think he? I mean, it's a shame that he has no time to deal with the problems of Franklin K. Lane High School, where kids are being beaten up and set on fire, and teachers are being raped.
The thorny problems of overcrowding. Of racial thorny. Imbalance.
Ouch.
Yeah,
ouch.
Thorny. Yeah. Yeah. It's Saltzman is picking some interesting terms.
Racial imbalance. What's racial imbalance versus balance?
That's a good question, Tim. The thorny problems of overcrowding, of racial imbalance, of lawlessness and violence continue to fester and grow. But Lane's problems were not only overshadowed by the Altamare-Shanker hassle, but by the larger issues that had begun to engulf the Union and the city. In addition to the Vietnam issue, there was the emerging crisis over the dismissal of 19 Union teachers without charges by Rhody McCoy in the predominantly black yes. Ocean Hill Brownsville demonstration school district.
That was the signal to break up the Black Jewish Alliance because they fired a bunch of Jewish teachers, right?
Yeah, I think that's what that was.
Yeah. So Harold Cruz writes about it in his book about that. Yeah.
Oh, does he?
Yeah,
book is that?
I think it's called The Black Jewish Alliance, The Crisis of the Black Intellectual or Negro Intellectual, I think. I think mm-hmm. that's it. E. Michael Jones references a lot in his work on Slaughter and Slaughter of the Cities. But this was the signal. This is 1967, and this is when many of the Jews in America became Zionists and concerned with Israel over black radicals, and they stepped back from supporting the Black Panthers, radicalizing the Black Panthers, and all that. And so it was happened that they wanted black teachers and they fired all these Jewish teachers. As you mentioned, 40,000 of the 60,000 teachers are Jewish.
Yep.
You know, I know it's New York City and they have a higher population maybe, but that's very dense of you. Disproportionate if you ask me, but that was a function of that. And so that's why it collapsed in the late 60s and 70s. The Black Jewish Alliance that, you know, people speak of, you know. And then when it was revived recently, you know, with the what was that that's town in Missouri, the riots, the guy who was
Michael Brown,
and there was Black Lives Matter, and George Soros started pumping money into Black Lives right. Matter, so yeah. There's been a revival of the Black Jewish Alliance, which the ADL has single-handedly shattered, you know, with his war on Kanye West.
Yeah, and he still is trying to put tweets out talking about how, you know, fellow travelers in this, and
yeah,
you go into the comments and you see from obvious black people commenting, and they're just not having it.
No, Greenblatt. Yeah, Jonathan Greenblatt.
Jonathan Greenblatt,
yeah.
He's just exceptionally vile. All right. With Lindsay abstaining and the school board vacillating and refusing to protect the job rights of the transferred teachers, McCoy insisted that the teachers were being legally transferred to the central board for reassignment elsewhere. The union called a mini strike during the final 6 weeks of the school year, shutting down all of the 7 schools in the demonstration district. At the same time, a battle was being waged in the halls of the state legislature pitting the UFT against the well-financed Ford Foundation-sponsored groups, which were lobbying vigorously in behalf of the Bundy proposals for community control of the schools.
Why would the Ford Foundation be interested in that? They're just charitable, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Henry was rolling in his grave at this point. I mean, just spinning. The Bundy plan would have dissolved the central board and fragmented the school system into scores of completely autonomous community districts based on race and ethnic background.
This is interesting. How do you reconcile that with Brown versus Board of Education?
It just seems to be a reversal. Almost seems like someone came up with the idea of how to fix the problem at Lane. But I'm sure there's going to be some... I'm sure everybody's going to be behind this, so let's read on. The legislation, if passed, would have emasculated the union, rendering it helpless to protect the job rights and professional security of teachers. It was an issue that struck at the very lifeblood of labor leaders throughout the nation, and it was little wonder that Van Arsdale of the Central Labor Board and Meany's AFL-CIO stood staunchly behind the UFT president in his struggle against Ocean Hill. At the same time, political leaders throughout the state were shocked by the excesses of the new experimental district. Thanks to the efforts of State Senator John Marchi, an interim decentralization bill was passed which put off a final decision for another year. The law allowed the mayor to stack the school board with four new appointees while charging it with the task of coming back in 1 year with a final decentralization proposal. It was just what the UFT had wanted. The problems at Lane seems small indeed when compared to the fiery and emotion-laden issues of 1968, which were gaining national attention. The question of job security and the threat of teachers being tossed out of their positions at the whim of local Black extremists was far beyond important, was far more important than any immediate problem, however now, serious, at one particular school.
Now, the fact that these teachers were all Jewish, would that? Because that was the ethnic dispute, from what I understand, of the Oceanfront Brownsville strike.
Right.
Is it was a Black Jewish thing.
Well,
you can call them professional, you call them teachers, but I think what it was is that the blacks got sick of all the Jews over there, and they get out of here.
This definitely seems like what the problem was in this case. The Great School Strike in the fall of 1968 hit the city like a bomb. Locked in deadly struggle with John Lindsay and Rhody McCoy, Albert Shanker was in a position to demand absolute loyalty from his corps of officers and his executive board. This was something junior high school vice principal O'Neill, opposing the strike from the beginning, was unwilling to give him. But this was not the first time for internal division, and Shanker seized the opportunity to go before his executive board, charging O'Neill with having conspired to conduct private negotiations with McCoy and his Ocean Hill supporters and of subverting the union strike aims. As punishment and to remove him from the scene once and for all, Shanker demanded the termination of O'Neill's full-time employment as a vice president and his banishment to regular classroom duties. His punishment was to go back into the schools and get his ass kicked by Black students.
It's like being sent to the Russian front.
Oh, man. The following week, the vice president was also removed from the negotiating committee. But Shanker wasn't stopping with O'Neill. He hadn't forgotten Altamare's role in the 1967 strike or his part in the anti-war crusade on the executive board or the high school vice principal's disagreement with his own strike strategy in Ocean Hill. Arguing that the strike was placing the union in dire financial straits, it ended up more than $300,000 in the black for that fiscal period. Shanker cleverly coupled his purge of O'Neill with the claim that the union could no longer afford to pay the salaries of three full-time vice presidents. Elementary school's VP Levine was retained, but O'Neill and Altamare would have to go, he insisted.
Hmm.
You noticing?
So the two goys?
There was no opposition to the ousters except from O'Neill.
Is this how they took over Harvard?
There was no opposition to the ousters except from O'Neill, who accused the president of creating a dictatorship, of stifling creative thought within the leadership, and of surrounding himself with sycophants as top advisors. From Altamare came not a whimper. Accepting his emasculation, he returned to Lane, quietly, when the strike finally ended in late November. Shanker later went on to hire six additional special aides and presidential assistants at salaries equivalent to the $14,000 earned by the vice presidents. And the UFT leader, who had his own salary doubled to $37,000 and later $50,000, in addition to a Manhattan apartment and a new car on the union tab.
You mean he got rent paid in Manhattan?
I mean, even back in 67, 68, we're talking, for what salaries were. Yeah. I mean, that's amazing. He's making $50,000 and he has his rent paid and a new car. What about the kids, man? While the high schools were being torn apart from within by Black militant students and assaulted from without by adult agitators, the UFT high school vice president was stripped of all authority to represent his constituency. First, he was barred from making any public statement without authorization from Shanker's public relations man, Dan Sanders. Later, he was forbidden the long-established privilege of sending out written communiques, minutes, and notices of divisional meetings to high school chapter chairman and to high school chapter chairman and to members of the high school committee over which he now tenuously presided. His movements after 3 p.m., when he reported to the central UFT office, were carefully checked and sometimes directed by Feldman, DeLeonardis, and other Shanker aides. Even his secretary was placed in the general office pool, making it difficult, if not impossible, for her to conduct the simplest routines of Altamare's office. And most humiliating was the fact that high school matters that normally came under the purview of the high school vice president was given over to other officers and Shanker aides. George Altamare, in exile at Franklin K. Lane High School, had become a union vice president in name only. But the high school vice president was by no means the only victim. Following the Altamare O'Neill purge, Shanker moved deftly to root out any and all sources of dissent within the leadership and to establish his absolute personal control over the union. He's going full Stalin now.
I know. It's like, were there like giant billboards of his likeness all over the city and floating? Oh, I mean, dirigibles above the city, would they shine, you know, Clegg lights on him or something?
You wonder who in the secretary pool was the first one to stop clapping.
Yeah.
Within the ruling Unity Caucus, he insisted on the removal of its anti-war chairman, Saul Levine, and replaced him with Jeanette DiLorenzo, a district representative and fiercely loyal Shankerite. Earlier, Shanker had fielded his own candidate, Fred Nauman, a caucus newcomer, to oppose Levine in the 1969 Unity primary and to run for the junior high school vice presidency, which had opened up with the ouster of John O'Neill. The UFT president was outraged when the caucus voting in secret ballot nominated the veteran Levine over Shanker's personal choice. Nauman was later given the full-time job as director of the UFT College Scholarship Fund. So it looks like he probably created a position. Yeah. A lot of Carl Schmidt going on in here, too. The Levine victory in that bitter 1969 caucus primary convinced Shanker that the anti-war faction in the leadership had to be purged. With O'Neill already out and with Altamare struggling to get back into Shanker's good graces, executive board member Sanford Gellernter and Martin Lobenthal became the new spokesman for the anti-war faction. Along with Richard Parrish, UFT assistant treasurer and AFT vice president, the two executive board members were expunged from the Unity Caucus, ending long and distinguished careers in the teacher union movement. Even Reuben Mitchell, the venerable and much-respected member of the Teachers Retirement Board, was ousted from the officer corps when Shanker decided that his post as associate legislative representative should be an appointive by Shanker rather than an elective one. Needless to say, Mitchell, too, was active in the anti-war push and had also disagreed with Shanker over certain specifics of the school decentralization bill. The Unity Caucus itself had swelled to over 400 members as more Shankerites were brought in to participate in the closed-door political intrigue. But still burning over the Levine victory, Shanker quickly ended the traditional procedure of nomination by secret ballot and decreed that the caucus slate would instead be chosen by its 9-member steering committee, which, of course, had been handpicked by none other than Albert Shanker.
They are good at this stuff, man.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Want to stop it right there?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah. So what are your takeaways from this?
Well, again, it's like this labyrinthine or Byzantine bureaucracy of the union all supposedly this has something to do with education, but none of the businesses that concern the union and all these different offices have anything to do with actually improving the education of the kids, which is steadily deteriorating under, you know, under the forces of racial balance, whatever, imbalance, whatever you want to call it. And, I mean, there's nothing being done to improve the situation in the schools, address the problems in the schools, maybe to second guess some of the decisions that have been made in the past 15 years in terms of education. I mean, it was a bad idea to experiment with children. Brown wasn't particularly a legal decision anyway. I don't think the ruling even has any footnotes. You know, it was a concocted, you know, unanimous ruling. And I think it was what's his name, Frankfurter met with Thurgood Marshall behind the scenes.
Yeah, so there was no dissent, right?
Yeah, there's no dissent. So that was illegal, by the way. That's unethical. It's supposed to be, it's litigation, but it was set up. But, you know, the idea that the 14th Amendment required the schools to be desegregated when, of course, it was passed when schools were segregated. Obviously, it wasn't the intent of the 14th Amendment, just the desire of a later court responding to, you know, modern authority and all the modern Franz Boasian sociology in these things. But the violence that you read about in the school and in the early part of the book, you know, the children, students being assaulted, particularly the white students, for the most part, the teachers being set afire, being raped. These things are just, you know, these things, these are the few eggs you have to break to make an omelet, I guess, you know, in their eyes.
Yeah.
And all these people are feather bedding, building, giving themselves, you know, large salaries and plush apartments intriguing and setting on a little political empire. In the meantime, the whole school system is rapidly deteriorating. You know,
well, I mean, you really have to wonder, like, what someone like Shanker actually thinks of the students. I mean, does he think, you know, specifically the black students? Does he think, well, I mean, this is just a lost cause. We can't make this work. So let's just get everything out of, you know, let's just loot the treasury.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and, you know, they're fodder,
yeah,
for their political battles.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. In the end, he figures, you know, the whites that have enough money would just leave and go off to the suburbs, won't deal with it anymore. And you look at the school, it's a very beautiful school built, you know, mid-century, mm-hmm. I'm talking about, 40s, yeah. Maybe. 30s, I think it was built in the late 30s. And they didn't have any of these problems in the 30s up until
early
60s. Well, what happened?
I don't know. It's a mystery.
But yeah, civil rights, it's only a little ideology that factored. You talk about like anti-war policy and, you know, that pervaded everything. Why are their position on Americans' foreign policy, Americans' Vietnam War policy, factor into education? I don't know, but I guess everyone had to take a position on it then. I guess they had to endorse the president, I guess, you know, the AFL-CIO. And I guess also they were probably making money off. At the time, America manufactured a lot of the weapons ordinances that were being blown apart. I guess organized labor made money off that. So they supported it. You read it, the school and the schools become, you know, laboratories for social experiments. And no one cares. And the people making decisions their kids aren't going to the school. Maybe we still see that today.
Yeah. It's just the typical where there's no hope. Or, well, I mean, really, when you think about it, though, in 59, when Altomare is doing all this work to form the union in the late 50s, you're really not seeing the problems that you had, you know, they came into existence after 1964.
Mm-hmm.
Then. So really, it's you really can't say that they would be like, oh, well, let's form this union because it's hopeless. These students are hopeless. Let's just get all we can out of it. No, they just had the idea of let's get all we can out of this. And We'll protect our position. And then when things started changing in the mid 60s, it's like I said before. I mean, they're on autopilot. And
yeah.
It's like, what do we do? What do we have to do to keep what we have and not allow this violence and this rape and this burning to disrupt, you know, this basically this golden goose that we've constructed?
Well, because of the civil rights ideology, they can't address the problem. They can't engage the problem directly.
Because
the civil rights ideology is that blacks are victims and white people are the perpetrators, and they're guilty. And that was the judgment of the civil rights movement. And whereas white people fought, it was more or less white people. It was an act of extending, you know, the privileges and rights of Americans to a marginalized minority group. To many blacks, it was an uprising, at least how the media portrayed it, because the civil rights movement was this faux, you know, protest movement, which had the support of the, you know, of the regime, if you will. But the to them, it was an admission of guilt. White America was guilty. And it was, as Martin Luther King said, it was a down payment. And at that point, people should have just said, say what? What do you say? Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I'm reading in some of the earlier chapters, I'm reading how at the same time they're integrating the schools, creating the racial balance or mix, if you will, and I guess seeing how that experiment works, they're starting black studies or black curriculum programs to radicalize the students. They're this Afro-American association. They're introducing radical identitarian, curricula into the school material, radicalizing the students, and then throwing them together with the white students, throwing them in with the white students. What do you think? Yeah, obviously that's a very combustible situation. But why would you be encouraging black studies and Afro-American studies and black organizations at the same time you're talking about integration? You know, that's that again. We see that today, where only, you know, minority groups, colored groups, you know, colored persons of color can have their identity and their organizations, but white people are denied that. You know.
Well, you remember what happened the last time white people wanted to, have their own little paradise, huh, Tim?
Yes. You're not talking about that little city in South Africa, are you?
Oh, what is that? Orania?
Orania?
Orania.
I think it already has a GDP twice that of South Africa. So.
Well, I mean, that's...
I know the lights stay on. So.
and people aren't shooting each other. They're
not shooting each other, yeah.
Well, I don't know why that is, though. It doesn't make any sense to me. So, I'm gonna have to investigate that more.
It's structural racism.
That's it. Tell everybody where they can find your podcast, and we'll end this.
Okay, yeah, just it's Our Interesting Times. It's on Podomatic. You Google a search, you'll find it. I'm also on Rumble and Odyssey. I usually post there too.
Everyone listen. I never miss an episode. Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome. Have a good night.
You too.
Bye-bye.